Now on BBC Radio 4, it's Thinking Aloud with Laurie Taylor.
Hello. I wonder if anyone remembers a delicious sketch by the American comedian Shelley Berman about the perils of air travel. The moment before he actually boards the plane, he decides to take out some insurance. Nothing wrong with insurance, he says, but whatever you do, don't read the actual words on the policy, because if you do, you'll come across the word maimed. And maimed, observes Berman, is a horrible word. I mean, injured conveys the meaning, but maimed, it sounds so permanent. It should be stricken from the English language. Well, decisions to strike out words can, however, be informed by rather more serious considerations than personal sensitivity. In this extract from George Orwell's 1984, Winston Smith learns from his colleague Syme about the way in which Big Brother is purging the language of concepts incompatible with the political regime of Oceania.
You are hard at work on the dictionary, I suppose?
Yes, I've reached the adjectives at last.
I can see we'll have a busy time when it becomes compulsory, learning all the new words your department's invented for us.
Well, we're not only inventing words, we're destroying them. Scores of them, thousands every day. By the year 2050, the whole literature of the past will have gone. Milton, Byron, Chaucer, they'll exist only in newspeak forms. Even the party slope. How will you say freedom is slavery when the word freedom no longer exists? The whole aim of newspeak is to narrow the range of thought.
To narrow the range of thought.
In the end, we'll make thought crime literally impossible because there'll be no words to express it.
Donald Pleasance and Peter Cushing in a 1954 BBC adaptation of Orwell's dystopian novel. It's an example quoted in a new book called Through the Language Glass, How Words Colour Your World. It's an example which, according to the author Guy Deutscher, nicely illustrates the mistaken idea that the language we happen to speak is a prison house that limits the concepts we're able to understand. Take away the concepts, goes that argument, and the thoughts conveyed by those linguistic terms also disappear. Well, to discuss the complex relationship between words and thoughts, I'm now joined by Guy Deutscher, who is an honorary research fellow at the School of Languages, Linguistics and Cultures at the University of Manchester, and by Anthony Grayling, who's professor of philosophy at Birkbeck University of London. Guy, your book, as the title suggests, explores this relationship between thinking and language. I suppose the crudest notion of the relationship, really, is that the language you speak, there is something about the way that you speak, the words, the way the words are put together, the grammar or whatever, which demands a whole way of thinking, so that German language suggests a way of thinking that is not the same as the way of thinking suggested by the English language.
That's right. Well, I think there's even a cruder way of sort of types of prejudices about language that one hears. The simplest form is that this language or the other is ugly or even vulgar, and obviously this always applies to the languages of other nations. And actually, I think the most awful things I've heard were among nations that are meant to be great friends. When I spent a year in Scandinavia as a student, I heard that in Sweden, for example, it's common knowledge that Danish is not a language but a throat infection. And even, even worse things were said by great thinkers in their great works. We may all think of Italian as the height of elegance and chic, but if you ask Dante, he would have told you that the language spoken by the inhabitants of Rome was not really a dialect, but just a vile jargon. And he said this wasn't surprising because the inhabitants of Rome stand out for the ugliness of their manners and outward appearance. But when you get to when you sort of go beyond these merely ludicrous prejudice to I would say creative fantasizing, this is when you start getting statements like exactly speaking German would necessarily make you philosophize, or speaking French immediately makes you romantic, or statements the language of a tribe somewhere is so primitive that it has absolutely no grammar and just a few grunts and groans, or the notion that if you don't have a future tense in your language, then this means you necessarily cannot understand the concept of futurity.
So we're moving away from really, as you say, the rather cruder notions that, your way of being, your whole culture is determined by the form that your language takes. I mean, towards the more, Anthony, the more sort of familiar idea that language constrains thought. If the words aren't there, I can't have the thought. I mean, we're seeing that in 1984. Get rid of the words and people can no longer think about freedom. If freedom isn't in the vocabulary, we can't have the thought.
Well, to some extent, it's true that you could argue that it's true that if you don't have a vocabulary for something, that you can't make the kinds of distinctions that the vocabulary permits. For example, if you know very little indeed about nature study or botany and you walk in the woods, you might have a wonderful poetic experience. But if you can't differentiate between oak and elm or between one kind of flower and another, if you don't have the names for them, it's possible that you might have a less discriminating experience of the things than a biologist would have.
You might not see them even because they're not marked out or they're not distinguished in language.
Well, I think likely that you might see them, but you might...
See what is a daisy, see the difference between, say, a daisy and a dandelion.
Yes, indeed. You would be less conscious of them or less acute in your differentiations of them. So in one sense, having a vocabulary permits a much finer and more discriminating kind of experience. But I take it that Guy would agree, perhaps, and something I got out of his very fine book, that you can acquire the vocabulary and therefore you can acquire the distinctions. It's simply not the case that these things are closed to you. It's not a matter of necessity, it's an entirely contingent.
Let me just pop in one thing, because many people talk about having inexpressible thoughts, don't they? I mean, they simply say, oh, good heavens, I got the feeling when I was standing there, I can't put it into words, don't ask me to explain, there are no words for it. You concede that the thought is possible here, but you might want to say, well, if you had words, then indeed the thought might be a more refined one?
I think that there are occasions when we can't find words for things. I mean, this happens often enough, when we encounter something that, in the refined manner that we sometimes say these things, gobsmacks us. we can't find a ready idiom. But I'm pretty sure that if we tried hard enough, if we made the dogged struggle that William James said is what philosophy consists in, that we could find an articulation for our thoughts.
Now, let me come to you, Guy, because we want to, let's look at this historically, because a lot of the argument about the relationship between language and thought, in recent years, brings up the name of Benjamin Lee Whorf and his 1940 study of the language of the Hopi tribe. Just tell me about what it was he claimed to find through his analysis of the language here.
Well, Whorf essentially seduced his whole generation into believing that speakers of Hopi, but the speakers of American Indian languages generally, have, just because of the language they speak, have a completely different notion of reality from ours. And he used many examples, but this particular one, he claimed that the Hopi language has no words whatsoever or any expressions to express time, nor tenses. And therefore, Whorf claimed, a Hopi Indian, knowing only the Hopi language, would simply not be able to understand the concept of time as we know it.
And other people like Steiner came in and talked about the implications of this for people living in a world in which there was no future tense.
Exactly. And many people in the following decades, including Steiner, quoted Whorf almost uncritically, as if this was simply mere facts, and applied the same argument to a host of other languages. In Steiner's case,
was Whorf misinterpreting the evidence that he got? I mean, how did he come to this conclusion, which you would want to suggest was completely erroneous?
To start with, Whorf was, let's say, rather cavalier with his facts. It turns out that the particular language that he was claiming was a timeless language has a very elaborate tense and aspect system, and it has dozens of different expressions for different concepts of time. Whorf never bothered to visit the Hopi tribe in Arizona. His information was based on conversation he had with one Hopi informant who happened to live in New York City. But even... the more fundamental question is not just the fact that Whorf's facts were invented, essentially. The whole notion that simply, as we said, because you don't have a certain word in your language, this means that you are unable to understand the concept is ludicrous. And you just mentioned this before, but you can also think about it in a theoretical way. If this were true, it would mean that you would never be able to learn anything new, any new words or any new concepts.
So, I mean, it's interesting. I think you used the example of something like Schadenfreude. I mean, that we may lack the word, Anthony, but that doesn't mean to say that it cannot be explained to us the work the world is doing and for us to therefore recognise what it's doing.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, Guy's just made the point that we wouldn't be able to learn anything new if that were the case. But it also applies across languages because, of course, there's this mythology about the fact that in some languages there is an expression which captures something that in our own language we don't capture in exactly that way. All, at most, that means is that in our own language we need to paraphrase, we need a paraphrasis, circumlocute to express the idea there because we don't have a red idiom in our own language. So all ideas are available to all human beings, even if sometimes it takes us longer to say it than others.
Now, of course, at the other extreme, the argument is, I mean, here we're talking about the ways in which language may affect culture. We're going to go on and talk about that for another. But along come people like Chomsky, and I think we could put Steven Pinker into the same bag, who want to say, listen, there is something universalistic about language. It's innate, it's a given, and there's really no great point in exploring differences between language and trying to read off things about culture from that. Language is a given, that's it. Now, you don't want to go along with that, do you, Guy?
No, what I'm trying to do in the book is, in some sense, to save the idea that language can actually influence the way we think from Warfianism, from the charlatanism of the past, and suggest that
influence but not determine.
Exactly. Yeah. And what I try to show is that the major error that Worf made was to assume that language is a prison house, as you said, but whereas there's absolutely no evidence for that. But if we want to look at the real influence of language on thought, we have to look at the relevant differences between languages are not in what each language allows its speakers to say, because in theory, at least, every language can express any thought, but in what different languages oblige their speakers to say. As Roman Jakobson put it, the relevant differences is in what not in what each language may say, but in what it must say.
So language influences thought in certain areas, and I think one of the things that you might cite is like spatial relationships. I mean, it gives us backwards and forwards and sideways, but you can find certain sorts of groups of people, certain tribes, in quotes, who actually have more elaborate systems of orientation, which you would want to say influence the way they look at the world?
Exactly. For a long time, for centuries, people thought that the way we describe spatial relations is with words like behind or in front of or left or right, is universal and natural, just a sort of a fundamental building block of language and thought. But then a remote Aboriginal language from North Queensland was discovered, where people actually never use concepts like in front of or behind or left or right. Instead, they describe absolutely everything in cardinal directions, west, north, south, east.
How much do you, Anthony, want to concede to culture in this respect, or how much are you a Chomskyan or in terms of wanting to subscribe to a universal nature of language, a given nature, an innate nature, which really bends very little with culture?
Well, one has to distinguish first between the fact that obviously a capacity to use language, to be able to process language, has to be hardwired. I mean, we're all, I hope, around here of the view that the language bump on the left cerebral hemisphere in most all right-handed, most left-handed people is specific to linguistic capacity, and trauma to it makes you aphasic in one way or another. So there is some hardwiring there. It's an inherited, evolved capacity in human beings. And so something in the structure of the brain is responsible for the ability to learn any natural language if you're put into that natural language community and exposed to it early on. But then, and that's perfectly consistent with the thought that the language we, in fact, learn, and the kinds of habits of thought and of speech and of emphases and of things that matter, matters of interest and focus for that culture, will be embodied in the natural language that we learn, and it will indeed shape our way of thinking about the world and responding to it. Now, these two things are perfectly consistent. The interesting question is, and I think Guy points out in his book that a lot more empirical work is needed to tease this out, and maybe it will come from some of the, you know, nearly vanishing languages in the world today, is which aspects of all languages are so universal that they reflect to the hardwired aspect of language as opposed to the cultural aspect?
I love to end on a big question. That's where we'll have to end. Anthony Craig and Guy Deutscher, thank you very much. Words, words, words. If only they didn't take up so much room, then I could do better justice to your emails. But I can find space for some of your comments on the family history discussion we had 2 weeks ago. I've got space for Daniel Abrams. Laurie, listening to your discussion of genealogical research, I was reminded of a lecture by the anthropologist Mayor Fortes. He observed that there were two kinds of descent systems, one where you trace every ancestor and the other where all you needed to know was the founding ancestor. He concluded by observing, I'm descended from Aaron. And also space for Trudy Foster. Laurie, I work in an archive filled with passionate family historians, and I think you need to mention that family history also promotes social inclusion. People who find it hard to connect elsewhere can feel at home and relaxed in environments where they totally fit in. Family history goes way beyond just looking up your ancestors. Thanks, Trudy. Thanks also, Stephen Wicker and Mike Hill. And just time for words prompted by last week's discussion on black music. Ian Whitney found it very opinionated. Your guest this entire argument boiled down to the eternal complaint, music was better when I was a kid. Others like Karen Taylor found it over-intellectualised. Why didn't someone say the unsayable? Black music was way better in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Well, Elias Diamantis was worried about the disdain with which I treated hip-hop. I sincerely believe that hip-hop is the only palpable sea change in popular music in living memory. Thanks also, James Ashdown, Murray Hamilton, Gordon Petherbridge. In case you have any comments, praise or abuse you'd like to heap on today's guests or their contentions, or just on me, then here are our addresses. Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, broadcasting House, London, W1A, 1AA, or you can email us at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. And don't forget, if you want to hear the programme one more time, consult our archive, sign up for my newsletter, this week, Pardon My English, or download our podcast. All you have to do is go to this pretty little website and click through bbc.co.uk/radio4.